Hey there, Dr. B here with your Module 2 clarifying lecture. I'm out of town this weekend and going to see a client, so a little bit of a new locale, but same stuff going on today. Wanted to do some quick announcements. Learning sets seem to be going well. If you see any errors there, please report them to the developers. And a word about quizzes, I typically wait till the quiz closes before I address any problems. So if you don't hear from me, it's because I'm waiting for that quiz to close. This week is your annotated bibliography. I know this is a little bit late, but I want to talk a little bit about what I want to see in there. First off, your abstract should be in your own words. Make sure that technical jargon is defined. We talked about why in an announcement that you want to give credit where credit is due, of course. And you also want to make sure that you're showing to me that you're getting the material. So make sure that you're defining any technical jargon as well. Make sure you're using 7th edition APA style. You'll see that there's many resources from the library, and Anne Melville, who is our CEHD librarian, is very good at getting back to people and helping them with their search. If you come across an article that's behind a paywall, please use that proxy link that I sent you or contact Anne Melville first for interlibrary loan. Don't pay for articles if you don't have to. Use the resources that are from campus that will help you get those articles for free. All right, I wanted to talk a little bit about inner teaching and what I saw there. The book itself can be a little loose with terms sometimes. I will be very strict with terms. So we're going to use reinforcer rather than reward. We're going to make sure that we're reinforcing behavior, not people. And why is that important? It's important because if you start getting loose with the terms, then you might get starting to get loose with the concepts as well. So what I want to make sure is that you have precision so that when you have to use these things, you're going to be able to apply them with precision. The other thing about reinforcing behavior rather than people, I think it's really important. We're not in the business of changing people. We are in the process of addressing socially significant behaviors. So we want reinforcement to affect behavior. We don't reinforce people. And also, as Phil Heinlein said, if you reinforce a person, you're increasing the likelihood that they're going to occur again. And when we get to extinction, that's probably a really bad idea. Also a punishment. We don't want to punish people. So in that vein, I want to talk a little bit about concepts and principles. First of all, they're not interventions. Okay, they're concepts and principles that encompass the entire world. So you and I are under concepts and principles. Animals are under concepts and principles. The government is under concepts and principles of behavior analysis. When you get into a car, there's concepts and principles of behavior analysis going on there. When you go to the grocery store, same thing. So they're not interventions. I don't want you to think of what you're learning as interventions as much as they're concepts, they're principles that you will then apply to interventions. I also want you to make sure that you're reserving positive to add and negative to subtract. Please don't use positive to mean good and negative to mean bad, because when we start talking more about positive and negative reinforcement, that's going to serve to confuse you a little bit, because you're going to be like, oh, positive, happy, you know, reinforcement, and that's not how it works at all. You can be completely miserable and still have your behavior reinforced. So I want you to really reserve positive to as plus and negative as minus. I'm seeing some people say reinforcement and consequences. Consequences can be reinforcing or punishing. So it's any stimuli that comes after a response that affects the probability of that response happening in the future. So you want to make sure that you're talking about consequences as both reinforcing and punishing. And I know colloquially we talk about consequences as bad things, but again, behavior analysis doesn't differentiate between good and bad. We differentiate between that which is reinforced and that which is not. So with regard to reinforcement and strictness with the terms again, make sure you are not using the term the reinforcements. I know I see that in the book. It drives me crazy because reinforcement is not a thing. It's a process. So there's no such thing as reinforcements. Reinforcers are stimuli that that strengthen responding, but there's no such thing as the reinforcements. I will take points off for that. Remember that it isn't reinforcement unless your behavior changes. Okay, so no matter how happy, how much it quote unquote should be a reinforcer, if behavior doesn't change, it's not a reinforcer. So in some ways, you can only know what's a reinforcer after the fact, but you can start making educated guesses. Again, remember that you can't reinforce or punish people, only behavior. I will take points off for that as well. There's also no such thing as self-reinforcement. I know that the book again talks about this. It's kind of a controversial thing, but in order to reinforce a behavior, you have to kind of have control over the contingencies. And we don't really have control over our own contingencies. We might think we do, but that's a bit of an illusion. We can also kind of fudge things and stuff like that. A lot of things come into play when it comes to self-reinforcement, and it's best to just stay away from the term altogether. Also, I want you to stay away from the term intrinsic reinforcement, because there really is no such thing. There's reinforcement that happens under the skin. So things that might be what we call automatically reinforcing, or things that happen under that skin. But really, reinforcement is reinforcement. So reinforcement that happens under the skin is the same as the stuff that happens outside in our world. So there's no differentiation between intrinsic versus extrinsic. There are times when we get into schedules of reinforcement where you're going to see that behavior is displayed or emitted based upon very, very thin contingencies that sometimes look like there's no reinforcement happening, or that there's intrinsic reinforcement, when in fact there is reinforcers. There are reinforcers in the environment. They're just delivered at such a thin schedule that it looks like it's automatic. So that's just something to consider. In autism, we've created some of these really informal jargon things. You know, calling kids kiddos is one. But another one is this idea of honoring mans. And I want you to kind of stay away from that term as well. And I want you to talk about reinforcing a man. Because a man is verbal behavior that specifies the reinforcer. And in order for it to continue, it has to be reinforced. So honoring mans is kind of like rewarding behavior. You're not really specifying reinforcement in that case. Make sure that when you are talking, that you are avoiding explanatory fictions and mentalism. So what's mentalism? Mentalism is where we're ascribing inside causes to behavior that are probably better explained by the environmental contingencies. So that we got angry and then punched a wall. Getting angry is actually a response to an outside stimulus. So it's a behavior that happens in conjunction with the behavior that we see. So it's not that one causes the other per se. And we'll talk a little bit about rule governance later on in the term, but anger and emotions are kind of co-occurring behaviors with these overt behaviors. And so if you're saying that an emotion causes a behavior, you're actually skipping a step, because it's actually some sort of environmental stimulus that then evoked that emotion and that overt behavior together. And both of those things are reinforced. What's an explanatory fiction? An explanatory fiction is where you have circular reasoning. So, for example, Joey can't sit still because he has ADHD. Well, how do you know he has ADHD? Well, he can't sit still. And you can go on and on and on in a circle about that. When we have these terms such as ADHD or autism or anything like that, we're really just using a term to describe a set of behaviors that are common to people who end up having this label. So really, you know, when people talk in the disability field as disability as a construct, in some ways behavior analysis agrees with that, that it's not so much that it's, you know, an organic thing per se. It's more that there's this cluster of behaviors that come together and we call it that. So it's really, you know, the terms such as the things that come in the DSM-5, they do change over time. They evolve over time as our explanations become more precise. Do they have a purpose? Yeah, they do. Because it gives you a name to this cluster. It shows that, you know, you're not the only person with this cluster of behaviors, that type of thing, and it can guide some interventions. However, I want you to make sure that you're understanding that that's also verbal behavior. All right, so the Skinner question, why did you do that? And then they say it's probably better to say, why do you feel like you did that, or what were you feeling? And this one is really kind of misunderstood by students a lot. So one thing to make sure that you understand is that the only person who can observe what's going on inside of you is you. And your description may or may not be accurate. It may be that it's not accurate because you're not observing it in the right way. It could be inaccurate because you've decided to distort what's going on. And it could be inaccurate just because it's inaccurate. So we don't necessarily rely as much on reports of what people say about their internal states as much as we do looking at overt behavior. It's not that it doesn't exist. It's just really hard to measure by an outside person. Now, with ACT and relational frame theory and some of those things, it's getting a little bit easier. But for the most part, we try to stick with what's observable and measurable because we can't reliably observe what's going on underneath somebody else's skin. And so what he's kind of saying is that when we ask people, why do they do that or how do they feel about that? And someone says, I don't know. They're probably right. A lot of these things occur at the subverbal level. So when you look at Skinner, what he's saying is that most of the time we're not really good about talking about ourselves. We're usually better about describing the behavior of others. And when we ask these questions, they're kind of loaded questions because there's a lot of things that we may not be able to explain. The mask question. There's a lot of complex contingencies going on with masks. You know, no matter where you stand in the issue, there's so many things going on. For example, something called delay discounting. So shorter, sooner reinforcers usually evoke more behavior than larger, later reinforcers. If you've ever been on a diet, you know what I mean. So putting on a mask, the reinforcer isn't necessarily apparent right at the moment. And on top of that, the reinforcer for wearing a mask is to escape or avoid. So if we're doing escape or avoidance behavior, does that mean that, you know, if we didn't do it, then, you know, that thing would happen? Well, you know, technically, yes, but with masks, it's kind of hard to tell because that, you know, the COVID is going to happen way later. So for that kind of explains a little bit why, you know, it's hard to get people to wear masks. People's learning history around this stuff may affect whether or not they wear masks or how they feel about masks. And there's just so many different things that are going on. So let's get back to history a little bit and talk about what we call selection by consequences, or what Skinner called selection by consequences. So if you look at genetics, and for the most part, those things that promote our survival are things that tend to be coded into our genetics. That's our phylogeny. And that is also behaviors that are selected. So that's why most babies, quote unquote, instinctually suckle at the breast, because those that ate survived, over years. Those that did not eat did not survive. So we evolved to have some of these behaviors that sometimes we call instinctual that are phylogenic in nature. And then you have the ontogenic in nature. And that's, if you will, the nurture. So if phylogenics is the nature, ontogenics is the nurture. And so we have been exposed to lots and lots and lots of contingencies in our lives. We have been exposed to lots and lots and lots of different schedules of reinforcement, usually happening in tandem with each other. So when we learn about simple schedules, that's really a little bit too simplistic, because we're really working in multiple different reinforcement schedules at any given moment. So all of these things come together to have us select specific behaviors that go into our repertoire. The reason that I'm talking with my hands is because there's some sort of reinforcement going on for that. The reason that I'm staring at the little green dot is because there's some sort of reinforcement for that. And my learning history is unique to me. Your learning history is unique to you. We may have some commonalities, but for the most part, what we learn and what we select to be in our repertoire, and actually, it's the behavior selects itself. We don't really select it for ourselves. That assumes some sort of conscious choice or free will. The things that, the behaviors that are selected are a consequence of all of these reinforcers and punishers that have just come about in our lives. And so basically what I'm saying about the whole mass debate is that it's so complicated. No matter which way you sit on this debate, there's a lot of complex contingencies that go into how we behave, and to tease those out takes a lot of precision. Some of you have been using the term conditioned. We use that colloquially. I prefer the term learned, and that's because in 622 you will read Charlie Catania. Charlie was a is he's still alive? Is a, was a Skinner. A student of Skinner's, and he basically drilled into us that conditioning has some loaded terms to it, and that it's probably better to say operant learning and respondent learning. So I prefer the term learning to conditioning. I also think it's a little bit more precise, so it's just something to keep in mind. Motivating operations. We're going to be talking about those in more detail as the term progresses, but I want to make sure that you understand that motivating operations don't motivate people. Okay? First of all, contingencies don't do anything to people, they do stuff to behavior, right? The other thing about motivating operations is that they make either contingencies stronger or weaker. So I like to think of them as kind of like a dimmer switch on the contingency, that an establishing operation is going to make the contingency brighter, whereas a abolishing operation is going to make the contingency dimmer, and less powerful. So I like to think of motivating operations as kind of like the power of the contingency, if you will, or the strength of the contingency. That's what a motivating operation does. It doesn't motivate people, okay? And the term is kind of unfortunate in that sense, kind of like positive and negative reinforcement. We probably could have picked some better terms. The ethics are changing for behavior analysts starting in, I think, 2022, 2023. We're going to be going to a new ethical code. So keep in mind that anything that you're reading about ethics, or ethical behavior right now in this course is based on the Professional Ethical Compliance Code for Behavior Analysts. That's the old one. That's the one we still sit under, but there is a new one coming. If you have not signed up with the board, I recommend that you get an account with the BACB as soon as you can, because you'll get the newsletter. And anytime you get a newsletter, there's something important in it. So they don't do it like quarterly or anything. They only do it when they do updates. And it's important that you have that information, because if you don't, you may go awry in your learning. And before I forget, I do want to just make sure that you all are not using the term BCBA to refer to yourself. You can't say that you're a BCBA in training. You can't say that you're a BCBA candidate. You can't say that you're a BCBA student. The board believes that, you know, you either are or you aren't. If you pass the test, you are a BCBA. If you haven't passed the test and done all of the work, then you're not a BCBA. So you can say that you're a behavior analyst. You can say you're an ABA student. You can say that you're in an ABA certificate program. All those things are fine, but just leave off the term BCBA. And the last question in the inner teaching was about the grandparents and the single parents. A lot of you got the stuff from the ethical code, but you missed one really important thing. And that is, are they capable of following through? So can the single parent who works a 50-hour week come home and implement that behavior plan with fidelity, or might they just be way too tired? Can the grandparents implement that tool and training procedure, or might they have mobility issues that keep them from, you know, crouching down or coming back up or stuff like that? These are things that you have to look at. You have to look at the contingencies that surround not only your client's behavior, but also the people who are behavior change agents, because their contingencies and their reinforcers and their limitations are just as important as the ones that you're working with your clients. So that was the one thing that you all missed. And then we have one question. Are there any requirements for posting back and forth with group members, or is it just posting about the weekly meetings? You don't have to post anything back and forth. If you want to use the discussion boards to set up times, or you want to use it to further conversation, or you want to use text or Telegram or something like that to talk amongst yourselves, Slack channel, whatever it is, you can do that. The only reason that I would go back and look at that is if I had any doubts as to whether or not you all were collaborating. So as long as you all are collaborating, then, you know, whatever mode you use to collaborate and get together and talk is up to you. But if for some reason somebody complains that someone's not, you know, holding their weight, or I see something that looks like, you know, just it looks like only one person has answered all these questions, I'm going to go back and take a look. I'm going to take a look at, you know, your collaborate video. I'm going to ask you for text messages. I'm going to ask you for documentation that you all collaborated. So it really is, you know, in your best interest to keep the documentation, but I'm only going to look at it if it's a problem. All right. So thank you very much. Have a great weekend, and I'm looking forward to seeing you in Module 3.